وسهلا على راديو سي كي يو تي. Free Palestine. أهلا وسهلا على راديو سي كي يو تي. أبو عرب معكم يحييكم باسم فلسطين.
Yes, Free Palestine. You're still listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and 101.9 in Kingston, Ontario. We are under the olive tree, and you just listened to Mai Nasser. She is a singer from Lebanon singing Milh and Sukkar, Salt and Sugar. And we are excited to have with us Ben White here at the studio. Ben White is a writer, a journalist who is based in Cambridge, UK, and also a human rights activist specializing in Israel-Palestine. He is here in Montreal for his tour for his latest book, Palestinians in Israel. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
Your book, Palestinians in Israel, points out another essential dimension to the Palestinian-Israeli struggle throughout the years, specifically from the 1947-48. Talk a little bit about the book in general, and then we're going to go more into the details of what is you found out.
Yeah, I wanted to write the book in the first place in order to explain some of the key elements of Israel's policies with regards to the Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship inside the state, 20% of the population. And as you mentioned in your comments there, it's an aspect of the Palestinian struggle that a lot of people, including long-time activists, don't understand so well. There's not so much awareness about it. And certainly there is not much awareness, let's say, in the West about the ways in which Israeli policies towards the Palestinians inside the state, inside the pre-67 borders, go completely against the basic norms of what we would understand as a democracy. So apart from explaining key policies to do with land and planning and housing and citizenship rights issues and these sort of things, I also wanted to be able to make some bigger points about the nature of Israel as a Jewish state in general, and suggest that when you really get down to the core and the root of the conflict, Israel's identity as a quote-unquote Jewish and democratic state is a contradiction that has and continues to fuel most of the kind of core problems that persist to this day.
So you mentioned that you're talking about the bigger points about the nature of Israel as a Jewish democratic. Let's go into this subject more, and maybe give us examples of what is it to be a Palestinian who live in a Jewish community, a Jewish democratic state, yet they are minority, but they are the owners of the land.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny because when you were asking that question, you almost said, "What's it like to be a Palestinian in a Jewish community?" But it's actually a good way of giving one example. The majority of towns in Israel, which are very small, small towns, settlement communities, who can live in those communities is decided by a admissions committee. And the criteria for accepting a resident in those communities, one of the criteria is so-called social suitability. The person or the family has to be compatible with the kind of social fabric of the community. Now, given that all of those communities are Jewish in the first place, and also given that members of that admissions committee will often include representatives of organizations like the Jewish Agency and the World Zionist Organization, bodies that are not technically part of the state, but are granted large responsibilities by the Israeli state for several key functions. Given all of that, the admissions committee serves to exclude non-Jews, which actually doesn't just include Palestinians either. It would also include migrants, non-Jewish migrants who live in Israel. Serves to exclude them from those communities. Now, that's just one example there that came to mind as you asked the question. You can give a lot of examples, particularly in relation to land and housing and planning. Mm-hmm. And apart from the foundational mass land confiscation that took place in Nakba in 48 in the years that followed, that didn't just affect the Palestinians who had been kicked out, but also affected and continues to affect the Palestinians who remained. Apart from that land expropriation, you also find, for example, manipulation of planning legislation. You find that the Palestinian communities have problems in terms of housing density and an inability to expand, to grow naturally, because of the restrictions that are placed on them by the Israeli planning regime. So that's kind of one whole area, of which those are just some examples.
Can we talk, Ben, about education?
Yes.
Labor?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know how many people realize, but the education system is de facto segregated, in the sense that's not a legislated segregation, but because most Jews and Palestinians live separately, it tends to just happen that way. As I'm sure you know, that the schools are effectively almost always all Jewish or all Arab. Now, the segregation in that sense is not legislated, but with that reality, what happens is that there is discrimination in terms of funding by the central government to these schools. So there's a large funding gap between the kind of money that a Jewish student will have spent on him or her by the state compared to the money, the same scenario for a Palestinian student. And of course, this is very problematic for the whole community, because it's not just a discriminatory education experience, but that also creates further disparity further down the line, because if you've had an inferior education, of course, it's going to affect your job prospects too. And you mentioned labor as well. Again, this is another area where Palestinian citizens experience discrimination. There are whole sectors within the Israeli economy that are effectively off limits to Palestinians. One way that is done is by making a particular position dependent on a person having performed military service. And there are industries, particularly in the high-tech sector, which is very closely linked with the Israeli military, where Palestinian citizens are almost non-existent. And there are also government departments in the civil service, which is, of course, a big employer, where, again, Palestinian citizens are massively underrepresented, even in the areas of the country where they're proportionally more numerous. That's another big issue. Although I'll just add on that finally, in the last few years, there's been a discourse by Israeli politicians, including those at the highest level, the Prime Minister included, Netanyahu, talking about the necessity to improve the economic conditions for quote-unquote Israeli Arabs, and talking and even announcing and apparently initially implementing grant programs and this sort of thing. That is spun and presented as a way in which Israel is almost practicing positive discrimination in terms of addressing imbalances. But when you look at what's going on there, it's actually a result of a realization by Israel's business elite and political elite, that the only way for the country's GDP to continue to grow is for a greater for the Arab community to be more economically productive, because it's the unemployment's very high, the poverty level's very high. It's the same amongst the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, but they also get subsidies for their religious studies. So again, it's a bit different. But yeah, so the rationale is, well, we need to continue to grow as an economy, and so therefore we need the Arab Israelis to be working. So it's not really something that's come, as I'm sure won't surprise you, out of a kind of genuine desire for overcoming big structural discriminatory problems. But yeah, that's.
Ben, if we summarize, you were talking about some aspects of discrimination facing the Palestinians who live within the border of 67. What Israelis like to call the Arab Israelis, in order to, one of them, of course, is for the Palestinians to lose their identity as Palestinians, both culture and even family ties with Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza. Now, I want to take you to 2009, when you published, I believe it was your first book,
yes,
Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner Guide to 2009. And when we talk about Israeli apartheid, and we in early March, we're going to have the Israeli Apartheid Week in Montreal, people think about, yes, it's Israeli apartheid within West Bank and Gaza. After writing this book about the Palestinians who live in Israel, would you consider the elements that you talked about as part of the same apartheid system, but with different actions?
Yeah, this is a really important issue. And there's, as far as I'm concerned, there's a clarification that's really vital to give. Sometimes, or a lot, those who are advocating on behalf of Israel will say things like, how can you talk about apartheid because there are Arab members of Knesset, yes, there are Arabs on TV, there is, you know, you can, I don't know, be treated by an Arab doctor in a hospital or something like this. And all of their examples are, of course, given in relation to Israeli Arabs, to Palestinian citizens in pre-67 borders. I don't know. And certainly this is not the case for myself. I don't know of anybody who talks about Israeli apartheid just in the context of the pre-67 borders. Mm-hmm. You have some people who talk about apartheid in the context of the occupied territories, which is actually becoming a reasonably mainstream position in some ways, although maybe not in Canada, I don't know. But when I talk about Israeli apartheid and others, what we're saying is that the best way to make analytical sense of what's happening there is to think of it as one territorial unit, to think of it as one regime, because Israel is in de facto, yes, control of all of Mandate Palestine, and to see how, within that one regime, different groups of people have different rights or denied rights, granted rights, on an ethno-religious basis. So when you look at it like that, then I think it's very clear to talk about it in terms of apartheid, which is, again, this is a different subject, but not to say it's the same as what happens in South Africa. There are some big differences too, and the comparison doesn't do Zionism any favors either. It's worse for the indigenous population. But if you look at the whole area, you know, you have Palestinians in the Gaza Strip who probably have it the worst within the entire regime, because they're besieged, regularly massacred with impunity, etc. You've got Palestinians in the West Bank who have got no citizenship, who are subject to Israeli military rule. And of course, even within the West Bank, there's stratification too. So if you live in Ramallah, it's better than if you live in the Jordan Valley, and so forth. And then, of course, you've got Palestinians who have residency in East Jerusalem, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, as we've discussed. Within that category too, you have Bedouin lifestyle Palestinians in Naqab in the south who have got it worse than definitely worse than if you live in, I don't know, like Akkar or Haifa or something. So if you look at it as one regime, then it's clear that it's a regime that is designed to protect and enshrine privilege for Jews at the expense of Palestinians. And that's what we're really talking about when we talk about Israeli apartheid, that kind of holistic vision.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you travel, and you probably traveled in Al Jalil, and you see if there are more than three Arab villages all together on a mountain, they have to be ghettoed by a new Jewish settlement. Like if you look about Karmel, which started with a small, small, tiny town, like what's happening now in West Bank with small settlements. But over the years, they become huge towns and they become part of the fact, okay, this is the reality that Israel is trying to build there.
If I could just add something quickly there. You made a really good point about noticing the similarities between the policies in pre-67 Israel and in the West Bank. You know, the same logic, as you point out, is at work in the creation of the so-called development towns like Karmel and Nazareth Illit and the Mitzpim settlements in the Galilee, as with the settlement enterprise in the hills of the West Bank. And that's another really important point that a lot of people still don't quite get, that there is that continuity of purpose and of objective there.
Let's talk about, you mentioned a little bit having Palestinians inside the Knesset. And I know your book was forwarded by Hanin Zoabi. And specifically Hanin Zoabi's party that is in the Knesset, Balad, or Tajamma, it was violated by lots of different laws that it's supposed to be outcasting and it's not supposed to be in the Knesset. Does your book talk about the issue of the politicians that being elected by Palestinian politicians?
Yeah, so again, as I mentioned, like sometimes the fact that there are Palestinians in the Knesset is cited as, you know, proof of how amazing a democracy Israel is. And you know, it's certainly the case that from within the Palestinian community in Israel, there is disputes too about even whether this is an effective or appropriate method of trying to effect change. I mean, someone like Hanin and others from Balad are, you know, in the Knesset as they see it, in order to try and represent the interests of their community and their people, and to try and work to make Israel a genuine state for all its citizens. Of course, there are also those who say that participating in the Knesset at all is a kind of legitimization of something that shouldn't be legitimized. But I think if you look at the history of leaders within the Palestinian community in 48, there's a, you know, a clear, consistent strategy from the Israeli state's point of view of targeting individuals who develop the capacity to challenge the discrimination, to be a focus point for resistance. And Knesset members have been targeted in that way, and that's happening a lot even nowadays. Saeed Nafa, for example, who's on trial for a trip to Syria that he made, and he's a Druze, interestingly, who represents Balad, and is very, and I think one of the reasons why he's being targeted actually is because of the way in which he goes against the traditional Druze community position of identifying with Israel as a Jewish state. But it also, the targeting also applies to Palestinians, all the way down to individuals who do, you know, local organizing and NGO leaders. So, for example, my book is actually dedicated to Amir Mahoul, mm-hmm. who's a Palestinian political prisoner who was said by the Israeli intelligence on these charges they made up to be working with the Hezbollah and stuff like this. So yeah, I think the targeting, and you know, you go back, just a final point, you know, you go back to the first decades of the state's existence and the time when most Palestinian citizens were under military rule, martial law. And again, that system worked effectively, actually, you can say, to suppress dissent within the community, and a community that was, of course, shattered by the events of Nakba 2, but to place informers and spies within schools famously, of course, Mahmoud Darwish was called in by the military governor to explain a nationalist poem that he'd written as a child. So that's a thread that goes all the way back to 48, and it continues in different ways to today.
You mentioned briefly about targeting NGO leaders as well and targeting individuals. Can you tell us some facts about the Palestinian citizens of Israel? Or you mentioned some 10 facts about them.
Yeah, well, I can...
One of your favorites.
One of my favorites. I mean, I think one of the most revealing facts is to do with land and housing. You know, so since 48, there's been around 700 communities created for the Jewish population, and effectively zero for the Palestinians. Now, there's been a kind of half dozen established in the Negev, in Naqab, but actually the only reason they were created at all was to try and concentrate Bedouin Palestinian communities in a particular area. So if you just look at that disparity, if you look at the fact that the population has grown naturally over 60 plus years, yet the number of communities it has stayed the same. And in fact, of course, even those communities have lost such a dramatic amount of land. Estimates are at around kind of three quarters. The average Palestinian community lost three quarters of its municipal land from 48 until today. So it's that's a very strong, clear example. You could go on. I mean, if just a final one, I suppose, on that issue, is the phenomenon of the present absentees, the internally displaced persons, who, unlike the Palestinian refugees outside of Israel, stayed within what became Israel and got citizenship, although in some cases after a long time, but they still had their properties and their lands confiscated from them. And I know, there are many individual cases, but I know one family whose grandmother lives minutes away from her family's house, but can't go back. And these people are sometimes just, you know, a very short journey, a walk away or a drive away from their ancestral lands, from their village lands. And the only reason they can't go back is because they're Palestinian.
Ben White, thank you so much for coming over to our studios. Please do read and check out his book, Palestinians in Israel, that was released in 2011, and his earliest book, Israeli Apartheid, a Beginner Guide, that was released in 2009. Do you have a website? How people can find your books?
Yeah, I mean, my own personal website is simplebenwhite.org.uk. I'm on Twitter, and my handle is Ben Abiad, BenAbyad.
That's a translation of your name.
Yes, because Ben White's quite common. And I made a website for the new book, which is PalestiniansInIsrael.com.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks very much for having me.
أصلك نحفتك من العذاب. Thank you.